You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new GOP bill being considered in the state legislature would roll back the state's air pollution regulations and make the state fall more in line with federal guidelines. We'll talk to one of the bill's co-sponsors in just a bit. First, U.S. Representative John Conyers stepped down as the ranking Democratic member of the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. The Michigan lawmaker faces sexual harassment accusations from female staffers. The longest-serving member of Congress denies the allegations. Here's House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on Meet the Press yesterday before Conyers announced that he would step down from the Judiciary Committee.
John Conyers is an icon in our country. He has done a great deal to protect women, Violence Against Women Act, which the left wing, right wing is now quoting me as praising him for his work on that, and he did great work on that. But the fact is, as John reviews his case, which he knows, which I don't, I believe he will that he will do the right thing.
Heather Cagle joins us now. She is a congressional reporter for Politico. Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what's been the reaction to Nancy Pelosi's comments there yesterday? Kind of an ambivalent reaction to one of her House colleagues in a sexual harassment case.
Well, I think on Twitter you saw a lot of criticism, both from the right and from the left, not necessarily lawmakers, but commentators and things like that, saying that she should have taken a stronger stance, a stronger position. Privately, some members that I've talked to today and yesterday say they were pretty upset with how she handled the interview. They think that she didn't handle it as well as she should have and, you know, left it to kind of be an open question when they wish she would have been more definitive about the actions that Congressman Conyers needed to take after these allegations surfaced.
Can you talk about some of the allegations against John Conyers? What kind of things we're hearing from a number of women now in different mediums?
Yeah, so basically there are two main allegations facing Congressman Conyers right now. There's a report of a settlement from 2015 with a former female staffer who said that she was wrongfully terminated from his office for, quote, not succumbing to his sexual advances. And that includes things like some comments that he allegedly made, some inappropriate touching. And then separately, there was a complaint that another former female staffer filed in the court earlier this year that was later dropped that claims that Conyers sexually harassed her. She says that he, too, engaged in inappropriate touching, like rubbing her neck and shoulders, trying to hold her hand. She called him a repeated and habitual offender. Now, again, Conyers denies all of these allegations, but these are the two main ones facing him. And then the 2015 settlement, there were affidavits from other former Conyers staffers backing up this former employee's claim.
And so this comes after, of course, the sexual harassment allegations, the photo with Senator Al Franken. Talk about the position Democrats are in dealing with this issue. We'll get into Republicans and more general issues in just a bit.
You know, I think Democrats find themselves in kind of a pickle because when the allegations facing the Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore first surfaced, they were criticizing Republicans for not acting fast enough to shun Roy Moore and say he should step out of the race. And then these allegations come against some of their own, and they're kind of getting it back from Republicans who say you should call on Al Franken and John Conyers to resign. You should take more action than you're doing now. I think, honestly, what leadership in both parties is starting to realize and what aides have told me privately is that they expect more members to be publicly identified, and it can come from either party, likely both parties, and they're realizing that this is not a partisan issue and they should stop flinging mud and work together to kind of figure out how to address this long term on the Hill so it doesn't happen and that hopefully doesn't happen in the coming years.
Right. It seems like a lot of the initial response is if it's somebody on the other side, open fire verbally anyway. And if it's somebody on our side, well, they deny it. A lot of maybe hedging. And this is true of both parties?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think now everyone, it's safe to say everyone on Capitol Hill is on edge because they're waiting on the next shoe to drop. Who is the next member who will be publicly identified as a sexual harasser or someone who has settled a claim for harassment or something like that? And honestly, I mean, people weren't expecting John Conyers to be named, and that kind of taught both sides, I would think that, like, you cannot anticipate what is coming next, so we probably need to work together to overhaul the current system. And that's where things are moving in the coming weeks, I would say.
We're talking to Heather Cagle from Politico. She's a congressional reporter there. We're talking about sexual harassment issues in Congress. And Heather, let's get into those efforts. You write about a bipartisan effort to try to come up with better ways to deal with sexual harassment and prevent sexual harassment in Congress. What's going on?
Yeah, so this week, the House will vote on a resolution, likely Wednesday, the House will vote on a resolution that would require mandatory training for members and staffers, because believe it or not, currently, lawmakers and their staff, they're not required to undergo any kind of sexual harassment training. So this would change that. The Senate has already done that. They moved on this a few weeks ago. And then more broadly, some of the lawmakers really pushing this effort are looking to overhaul the current system for filing a complaint, because it's really not friendly at all to the victim, and they want to make it more friendly to the victim so that people feel more comfortable coming forward. And in the next couple of weeks, you could see some measures in between that don't require Congress to change a law, but will change the policies on Capitol Hill. And something that I was talking to a member today, her name is Barbara Comstock from Virginia. She's one of the lawmakers leading this effort. And she said something we could see in the next couple of weeks is a resolution that would ban members or high-ranking staffers, like chiefs of staff, from dating their subordinates. And right now it's frowned upon on Capitol Hill, but there's nothing that bans it. And they say that this is just one step in a long road to overhauling a system that is very burdensome for the victims and, you know, archaic.
Let's talk about that reporting process you mentioned. One criticism that's come from some members of Congress, among others, is that the process is not transparent. Settlements can be made. The public, constituents, the media, nobody gets to find out what happened unless it's somehow leaked potentially years later. Is that a fair way to sum up what's going on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think people have been really surprised on Capitol Hill to find out just what the reporting process is like and how confidential it is. And it's something that was kind of set up in the mid-1990s and hasn't really been addressed since then. Basically, if a victim wants to file a complaint, they first have to go through about a month of counseling, and then they decide if they want to enter into mediation, which is essentially their only option if they want to keep pursuing this complaint. And eventually, if they, you know, want to keep pushing this complaint, they have to enter into, like, a confidential settlement. And so members are trying to overhaul the system in a way that strips that confidentiality. They say we need to put more sunshine on this. With Congressman Conyers, it's a little bit different because there is an office on the Hill that has paid out many of these settlements in the past. Granted, we don't know to whom or how much because, like you said, it's kept under lock and key. But with Congressman Conyers, he actually used his membership funds to settle the 2015 claim and set it up to look like a salary. So no one even knew that, you know, I mean, there was no way to know that this person who was listed as an employee wasn't actually getting a salary but was getting a settlement payment. So that's something that members like Barbara Comstock and others who are really pushing the changes here, they want to get rid of that completely. They don't want members to be able to do that, you know. That way that the public really has better accountability of what's going on, because these are taxpayer dollars that are being used to settle these claims, and the public has no idea right now, and there's no way to find out unless it leaks to the media.
And in a lot of these efforts in Congress to tackle this situation, it sounds like a lot of it is led by women members of Congress and a bipartisan group of women, and we've heard some shocking stories from them, either in recent memory or looking back to when they were congressional aides themselves. There are a lot of people sitting in Congress who have personal experience on the receiving end of harassment.
Yeah, you know, one of the other leading members on this issue, her name is Congresswoman Jackie Speier. She's in California. She says she kind of kicked off this whole thing a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, by telling her story of how she was harassed when she was a young staffer on the Hill. And now she's a lawmaker. Some of the women, the female lawmakers who have spoken out about this, say that they know current members of Congress who have sexually harassed other members or staffers. Now, there has been some pushback from critics who say you shouldn't just say that these members are still sitting in Congress. You should identify them. And that has been a little bit controversial, but I think you are seeing this bipartisan effort mostly driven by female lawmakers, and a lot of them have their own stories to tell, and it's kind of really opened up this conversation on Capitol Hill that up until now was mostly whispered about by staffers, lawmakers, reporters, anyone who works on the Hill, but whispered about behind closed doors, and now it's just ripped into the open, and it's not showing any signs of abating anytime soon.
And in some stories I've seen, this maybe in your reporting, Heather, there's been talk from women involved in Congress now thinking, oh, back in the time of Anita Hill or Bill Clinton, we thought things are going to change then. Is there a sense that things are going to change now?
I think so. I think that, you know, I was talking to Congresswoman Comstock earlier. We had a lengthy conversation, and she was talking about another sexual harassment episode in the early 1990s with Senator Bob Packwood, who ended up being expelled. But she was saying that she has went back and really studied that and studied what happened then and also what happened with Anita Hill so that they don't repeat the same mistakes where they end up making changes to a system, but it isn't friendly to the victim. It doesn't encourage victims to come forward. It keeps things secret, you know, things like that. So they really are studying what happened in the last couple of decades and mistakes that they think past Congresses have made so that they don't repeat those. It will be interesting to see what happens and how they address these changes and things like that. I mean, part of it is that Congress will have to pass some kind of law to overhaul the current reporting system. They probably can't do that with just a resolution here or there. And that will require some push and pull from the Senate and getting it to President Trump's desk. And that does take time. So I think the question now is, can the members who are pushing this effort, can they keep the spotlight on it? Can they keep the public attention focused enough to where it will drive change in Congress and get to the White House and really overhaul this system?
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Heather Cagle. She's a congressional reporter for Politico. She joined us to talk about how Democrats are handling accusations of sexual harassment in Congress and what changes are being proposed, bipartisan changes, to prevent sexual misconduct in Congress. First, a bill introduced in the state legislature earlier this fall would repeal the State Department of Natural Resources air quality regulations. The lawmakers seeking the changes say that the move would put the state more in line with federal guidelines and help stimulate Wisconsin's economy. Representative Jesse Kramer is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 59th Assembly District, which includes Kewaskum. He's a co-sponsor of the bill. Representative Kramer, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, spell out the basics of this legislation. If passed, what changes in Wisconsin?
Sure. So it's a very simple bill in a package of bills that deal with streamlining and eliminating certain regulations that do not need to be on the books in the state. So right now, we have obviously federal guidelines, federal clean air guidelines that we have to follow. And we also have additional state guidelines, state regulations that we have added on top of those federal ones. So right now, we are monitoring in Wisconsin 293 more potential air pollutants. So we have that many more on the books that we have to watch out for or look for than the federal government requires. Of those 293 additional pollutants that are on our books, only 94 have actually been emitted in the state. So we have a lot of things, a lot of red tape that businesses have to go through when they want to add on or expand or move here. That don't necessarily need to be there. And it's not that we're trying to, you know, a lot of the articles that have been out there say that we're trying to eliminate state air pollution regulations. That's not at all what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do is just review what we have on the books, and it's up to the DNR to scientifically determine what needs to be there yet or what can be eliminated down the road. So right now the federal government goes through a review process with their own clean air regulations every 5 years. This is an every 10-year review that once the air pollutant is on the books 10 years from now that would sunset, and they can repromulgate a rule if that pollutant should still remain on the books. So that way we're keeping it clean as to how much we have for regulatory burden in the state here.
How much of a business impact do you think this has had here in Wisconsin, having these pollutants tested for and regulated by the state DNR?
Well, the interesting thing is there was a report, Rob, that came out, I believe it was back in 2004, that the first year alone of having these additional pollutants regulated in the state would cost the business community $100 million. So that was the first year alone. So it does have an impact on state job creation here and business expansion.
Is there a case to be made that the state should have its own kind of local guidelines, maybe focused more on industries that are here in Wisconsin that maybe are under the radar of federal regulations?
Sure, absolutely. And that's why we're telling the DNR, we're not saying just eliminate everything. Once these sunset, don't ever put them back in place again. But what the DNR is going to have to do is to determine and to prove that these are pollutants that we may have a special need or a desire to monitor them, even though the federal government has not told us to do so. And we do have to look at surrounding states also and see what they're doing, obviously, with a similar pollutant. If we're going to monitor it, why doesn't Illinois and Michigan and Minnesota, things of that nature? So that's up to the DNR and the scientists at the DNR to determine what should and should not be on the books anymore. So we're not, as legislators, saying remove these 293 pollutants and get rid of them permanently. We're saying just go back and review them and decide what should be on the books and what should not be on the books, DNR scientists.
As far as timeline for that happening, if this is passed and signed into law, do those regulations over those 200-plus pollutants, do they disappear until the DNR reviews them, or is there a sunset period? How does that get implemented?
Absolutely not. There's a period of time where they will be able to repromulgate the rules. So right now, the way the bill is written, we would have anticipated this getting signed by the end of the year. I don't see that happening right now. I could, but I don't see it happening. But the way the bill is written right now, all of these additional pollutants over and above that exceed the federal requirements would sunset the end of next year. The way the bill is written, they would be able to start repromulgating rules January 1st of this coming year then. So they would have a year buffer to repromulgate the rules. Now, that doesn't mean they can't be doing the research and coming up with all the material and the data to prove that they need the rule in place prior to that. It just means that that's when they can start the repromulgation process. So there shouldn't be, and that's one of the things we did here in the hearing, that there will be a gap in coverage that we'll basically be running amok with no air quality rules at all in the state. Well, first of all, we have all the federal rules yet that we'd have to follow. And secondly, no, there should not be a gap because the DNR should be able to repromulgate the rules in that year prior.
Talking to State Representative Jesse Kramer from the Kewaskum area, talking about changes to air pollutant regulations here in Wisconsin. He's a co-sponsor of new legislation on that. Representative Kramer, as you probably know, environmental groups, some of them opposed to this, the American Lung Association. The suspicion seems to be, okay, there's going to be some stuff that we'd be better off regulating, continuing to regulate, that's going to fall through the cracks here under this legislation. Maybe political pressure on the DNR will keep them from re-regulating this after the sunset period. What would you say to them?
Well, that's interesting because we didn't hear any of the specifics from the groups that did testify as to the concerns that they had. The biggest concerns that we heard were the gap in coverage, the fact that we would not have any rules on the books, which, as I just addressed, does not exist. It's not an issue at all. And then the other one dealing with the fact that, well, we have pollutants here that we should regulate over and above the federal level. And I agree, we probably do. And we're not eliminating those. We're not getting rid of those. It is still up to the DNR to decide, and once again, the scientists at that DNR, to decide what should and should not be regulated. Now it'll all be done through a scientific process. They have to prove that we need these regulations, and it's going to be all open and transparent. So that's one of the reasons behind this bill is we want public accountability and transparency in why we have rules in place and rules on the books. This is more of a red tape review type thing. And we put it kind of in line with the RAINS Act, which, as you recall, was just recently passed, where you would review rules every decade also and go back and decide if rules should be in place or not. So we don't want to be continually writing laws and writing rules that just stay on the books forever. We need to constantly be reviewing and updating them and making sure that they do apply for the times that we're living in.
There have been reorganizations and staffing changes at the DNR. Is there the scientific staff still at the DNR to go through this laundry list of pollutants and say, yeah, that one should stay, that one should go?
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, the fiscal estimate that the DNR gave us on this bill, they said that they'd be able to reabsorb the cost of repromulgating these rules within their own budget right now.
And you talked about the timeline on this. You said you'd initially hope to have this passed and signed by the end of the year. You seem skeptical at this point. What is it looking like as far as timeline on this now?
Well, it is still possible. We're planning I believe the Senate's planning a hearing in the next couple of weeks here. So it is possible it would be pushing it to get done by the end of the year. But if we don't hit the end of the year mark, if we hit it in January, February, March, what have you, we can always amend it on the floor and extend that date that the rules will sunset initially. So we do give the DNR enough time to repromulgate what to be on the books yet.
And briefly, as we wrap up, you mentioned that this went along with other pieces of legislation in line with the RAINS Act, which calls for reviews of regulations. What are some of the other key bits of legislation out there on this?
Sure. We have another one right now. Actually, we're having a hearing on it tomorrow, the reformulated fuels mandate in southeast Wisconsin. We have six counties that have to buy a specific blend of fuel at different times of the year. Even the DNR has come out and said, well, you know, it's not really necessary anymore. The fuel is so much cleaner than it used to be back when these rules came off from the federal government. So we're looking at getting we're not saying you're not allowed to sell these blends anymore. We're just saying, EPA, please don't mandate this for southeast Wisconsin, where we have people on fixed incomes and small business owners that are across the county line that has been it's basically put them on an island where they have to pay another 10 to 25 cents a gallon, depending on the time of year, for their fuel. We have another one in Sheboygan County where we have a poorly placed monitor that monitors air quality. It's on the Lake Michigan shoreline. And unfortunately, what's been happening is it actually only collects air that's coming. It's called foreign air, coming from Gary in Chicago. We have another monitor that with the help of the DNR and the EPA, was placed along Highway 43, downwind of all the factories in Sheboygan County. That's picking up air pollutants. It's within the range that we need to be in right now, but the one that's picking up the foreign air on the lake shore itself is not.
And we'll have to leave it there. Representative Kramer, thanks for joining us. That was Representative Jesse Kramer, Republican representing the Kewaskum area in the state assembly, looking at new air pollution guidelines here in the state. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Now, President Trump's approval rating is sitting at just under 40%, but those that make up his political base have been very steady in their support. A new survey finds that a big part of that may have to do with trust. The UW Elections Research Center conducted a national survey that looked into issues like who voters trust to tell them the truth and who they want making the country's big decisions. For President Trump supporters, the news media and established politicians, each in their own way, didn't do too good. Mike Wagner is an associate professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison and an affiliate of the Elections Research Center. He blogs at prowag.me. Mike, thanks a lot for being here.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into the details of the survey, let's talk about this issue of trust and,
sure.
and why this is something worth tackling when we look back at 2016.
Well, usually when we think about political elections and elections for president, we think about the reputations that political parties have on a variety of issues and the reputation those parties have with respect to their performance in the job, right? So if the economy is growing, the party in power tends to be, you know, thought of rather well by the public. That makes it more likely that a candidate from that party is more likely to win election for president. And so when we think about trust, we think about the brands of the parties and which parties trusted to be more conservative, more liberal. But in 2016, Donald Trump really seemed to make the election about trust in him over all others. He regularly made the point that you couldn't trust other politicians that were running against him during the Republican primaries. These were accomplished people, folks like Governor Walker and Governor Kasich of Ohio and Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, people who'd won statewide elections in swing states. And Trump was saying, you cannot trust them. They're all politicians. They're all the same. You can't trust the news media because they say things that aren't true about me. And you can trust me because I'm rich, so I can't be bought. And he was able to tap into a part of the electorate that had felt ignored for a long time. And so far, they seem to trust him over all else, even when the news media regularly report on things that he says that just are not true.
So let's get into how you measure this sort of thing in this survey. What did you set out to find out here?
Well, we just wanted to understand people's attitudes about the president, their attitudes about other major institutions like the news media, and how those things influenced their attitudes about how the country should be governed. And so we asked people, when they disagree, who do you believe more often, politicians or the news media? Most people said the news media, about 70%. About 95% of Hillary Clinton voters said the news media. So when politicians and the media disagree, people trust the news media as an independent arbiter of, you know, the verifiable truth. Not so with supporters of Donald Trump. 80% of Trump supporters said they trusted politicians over the news media. So then we thought, well, if it's the case that politicians are trusted by Trump voters, maybe those Trump voters would like politicians making the decisions about how our government is run. So we asked all the voters in our survey, about 2,000 people in a nationally representative sample done by the Elections Research Center here, well, who should be making decisions about governing our country? Should it be ordinary people, politicians, or an equal mix? And Trump supporters preferred ordinary people way more than Clinton supporters did, and an equal mix as well, and they really did not prefer the politicians that seconds before in the survey they said they trusted.
So we trust the politician over the media when they disagree, but we don't trust politicians to run the government. This is what you found from the Trump supporters who were part of this survey.
That's right, and my interpretation of that is that the voters are saying they trusted Trump. And so when the question was politicians versus the news media, Trump supporters, I think, used the president as a stand-in for politicians in that question. And then when it came to who should do the governing, people didn't see Trump as the politician. They saw other folks in Washington, D.C., the swamp that President Trump says that he wants to drain. And so it's a kind of a complicated interpretation, because we didn't ask directly about when President Trump and the news media disagree, which I think would be a really interesting thing to investigate. We were more interested in kind of broadly generalizable ideas and then comparing those to Trump supporters and not Trump supporters.
We're talking about trust and politics with Mike Wagner from UW-Madison, and a recent survey looking at who voters trusted and who Trump supporters trusted in particular. And it seems like we could throw in one word here that might sum up both of those results you talked about: establishment. If you don't trust what you perceive to be the establishment, you might include in that the mainstream news media,
right?
And you might include politicians of both parties.
And you might include professors who engage in national surveys.
Sure.
Yeah, and so research done on supporters of candidates in the primaries. This is Wendy Ron at Minnesota and Eric Oliver at the University of Chicago. They found that one thing that Trump supporters had in common with Bernie Sanders supporters was a strong anti-elitist, anti-establishment sentiment. And so a lot of those folks did not like the two-party system, didn't like the primary process by which we get our candidates, don't like how Washington, D.C. works in general, and they were more likely, liberals to support Sanders, more conservatives to support Trump. Now, Trump and Sanders supporters had virtually nothing else in common, but they both were anti-establishment, and that's something that President Trump continues to use to his advantage as he governs in Washington.
And then let's get into, and this is something we've talked about a lot, President Trump versus the media, and that is a fight that his supporters like to see him engage in very much.
It's automatic. President Trump supporters almost always will endorse his critique of the news media. And usually the president will come out, as he has done in the last couple of days, and talk about what he calls fake news. Usually fake news is defined as bad news about President Trump. He almost never offers evidence that the news is in fact incorrect. He just says that it's fake. But he has a substantial a number of supporters who are willing to go along with him in that idea. Some of them feel ignored by the government. Some of them feel looked down upon by the government or the news media. And Trump has tapped into something in some of these voters where they feel he hears them.
And he talks in a way, this is a theme we keep hearing since the primaries, really. This is a person who doesn't talk like an establishment politician or media person. He doesn't speak in guarded language. And that, if you are someone who's suspicious of the establishment, of the elite, is refreshing.
Yeah, he does not speak the language of political correctness. Some would say he doesn't speak the language of general good cheer and civility. Just today, the president was at an event with Native Americans in front of a photograph of former President Andrew Jackson, who you might have heard of with respect to the Trail of Tears, which, you know, related to Native American history. But also then at that event, you know, once again, as he's done many times, called Senator Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. Some of his supporters really like that kind of direct, visceral language that most other politicians would not dream of doing when they knew a microphone was on.
Right. And again during the primaries and beyond, a thing would happen where if you pictured a different politician, an establishment politician, saying or doing that, I mean, there were analogs where it was a career ender for a lot of people, or it ended a campaign and it meant they'd reached the ceiling of their political career. He defied that kind of logic.
If Governor Walker had said that Megyn Kelly, who asked him a tough question, did so because she was, quote, bleeding out of her whatever, as President Trump said about Megyn Kelly during a debate, or if President Obama had said the things that President or then candidate Trump said on the Access Hollywood tape, those would likely be career enders for, as you say, for virtually anyone else. And he has been able to push back on those narratives and even deny that he said some of those things. More recently, it's been reported that the president is denying that the Access Hollywood tape is actually an authentic tape, even though he said it was before and apologized for it before.
And his tweets, of course, got attention all throughout the election, and other researchers, this isn't part of the survey now, looked at how those tweets drove coverage of then-candidate Donald Trump at periods where he wasn't getting covered as much.
That's right. In my department, in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, Chris Wells and Devon Shah, partnered with John Peavyhouse in political science and a cavalcade of graduate students to show that when the president, or then at that point, when candidate Trump's news coverage would dip, he would go on tweet storms, you know, where he lots of tweets in a row, rapid fire. And when those tweets got picked up by his audience, in other words, when they were retweeted, when they were liked in high numbers, the news media were more likely to start covering Trump again. And so when he got less attention, he brought the news media back via the power of social media, which kind of a hybrid campaign style that we haven't seen much of before.
And, you know, you can think back on politicians that you like or don't like who really thrived by taking advantage of whatever the new form of media was, fireside chats on the radio or the early politicians who mastered TV. Donald Trump did a lot with both how to get onto cable TV and social media that candidates hadn't done to this point.
Yeah, he's one of the first to really understand the rhythms of social media and how to get an audience to react. And he also, I think, has understood in a way that other politicians either haven't or have been a little too risk averse to try, the idea that he can ignite an audience to then affect what the news media itself, mainly talking about the national media here, will actually choose to cover.
And let's get back to the Trump supporters in your survey. Now, again, this is going a bit beyond the survey itself, but is this a way for Donald Trump, or maybe someone who uses these techniques in the future, to keep a minority of the populace, but an enthusiastic group of supporters, keep them enthusiastic?
I think so. And it's not new for politicians to criticize the news media.
Sure.
You know, since we've had politicians and a news media, politicians have criticized that news media. And it's a strategy that works. And when people who are seeking elected office can persuade the public that the news media are not to be trusted, that they are biased in some kind of way, they can hold supporters in environments they otherwise probably wouldn't be able to hold on to those supporters.
We're talking with Mike Wagner, Associate Professor of Political Science in the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at UW-Madison, looking at a new survey finding that supporters of President Trump are more likely to trust politicians than the media in a survey when it comes to telling the truth, but not trust politicians when asked who should run the country. You should join. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Let's ask you some of these questions. When the news media and politicians disagree on an issue, who do you trust? If you tend not to believe the news and the news media, what makes you think it's untrustworthy? If you voted for President Trump, was the party, was that R by his name the important thing, or was the candidate more important for you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Mike Wagner, Associate Professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison, looking at a national survey that finds supporters of President Trump trust politicians over the media when it comes to telling the truth, but don't trust politicians either when it comes to running the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In the political and media landscape, who do you trust? Who do you think we should be able to trust? What should politicians or the media or the president do differently to earn your trust? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I don't think that the media really has a liberal bias. I think their bias is more towards their own economic interests. And I think they'll do whatever their corporate people tell them to do to keep collecting a paycheck. An example of that is leading up to the Iraq War. The media was 100% behind cheerleading for it. They printed whatever Donald Rumsfeld said or Dick Cheney said verbatim. And even now, if you look at what's going on in Yemen or what's going on in Afghanistan, the media doesn't really cover the real issues. They just cover whatever is in their economic interest to cover.
Peter, thanks for the call. Mike, it's an economic institution. It's driven by economic needs, Peter's saying.
There is an argument to be made that that is really important. A lot of research suggests that market forces are an important factor of what drives some journalism in the United States. Les Moonves, who runs CBS, said that Trump was really good for the bottom line during the campaign. But it's also the case that the news media do push back on folks more than the economic model might suggest, and that's partially because, you know, the news media also, thrive on news values such as conflict. And so, like, the invasion of Iraq example from the caller is a really interesting one. There wasn't a lot of conflict between Republicans and Democrats who were elected officials before the invasion in 2003. And so reporters had to look somewhere else to find that conflict. And where they looked, according to some political scientists, Danny Hayes and Matt Guardino, was to foreign voices. And so foreign leaders would kind of fill and create the conflict between President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and others, because Democrats weren't voicing that conflict. And so part of it is who's willing to talk, but part of it is certainly a model driven by the economic bottom line.
Well, but if that's the case, then if there is an establishment consensus and there isn't that high profile, say, Democrat-Republican conflict, right, then maybe the media is dropping the ball a little bit?
So it could be that's the case. In the case of the invasion of Iraq and the subsequent war, the research suggests that it wasn't just that the news media were saying, well, Democrats aren't saying anything negative, so let's just report consensus. Now, President Bush got a ton of coverage and got more coverage than anyone else and got more positive coverage than anyone else in the conversation about whether or not the country should invade Iraq preemptively. But there were lots of other voices that did fill the void. It wasn't just the president. Foreign voices were included, local voices, and so it is the case that reporters will generally try their best to present as many sides of a story as they can tell. In our two-party system, two sides is a general rule of thumb for what reporters look for, but it's not always the case.
Peter, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Ray on the line in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
Hi, I consider myself a progressive, libertarian progressive, and I supported Bernie Sanders until Hillary threw him under the bus, and he said, wow, this is a nice view from down here. So basically, I have lost faith in American media and also in the establishment, Republican, Democrats, and who I look to for information is probably more overseas, the BBC, Deutsche Welle, the Japanese public station, I don't know what it's called, DHK maybe, I can't remember. But I'm just very frustrated with what's going on. And living in Milwaukee, we have progressive aldermen who have supported every condo conception here on the east side. So I've even lost faith in local government. I'm not even going to vote anymore.
Ray, thanks a lot for the call. Ray, a disillusioned person on the libertarian progressive edge of things. But this disillusion, as you were saying earlier, Mike, isn't just from Republican Donald Trump supporters.
No, Ray is not alone. A lot of people are very disillusioned with the political system, and they are very disillusioned with the news media that they perceive covering that political system. And so it's not surprising, and it's not uncommon to hear views like those from Ray. On the other hand, it is the case that there are politicians who make promises, work hard to keep those promises, and a news media that aggressively checks politicians to see if they are keeping those promises. But in an environment where compromise is often necessary to get the job done in a democracy, and that's something else that our survey looked at in the Elections Research Center was, would it be better for people to stand up for their principles in Washington or compromise to get something done. And Americans' views on that are deeply divided. Some want the compromise, but your caller seemed to say, hey, if my alderman in Milwaukee's compromising to get some building done, I'm not on board with that. And so it's a difficult path for politicians to figure out, when do I stand up for my principles and when do I compromise to move the ball forward?
Thanks for the call, Ray. We're talking to Mike Wagner about trust in American politics. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I think the biggest problem right now is the 24-hour news cycle. They want to get the news out so quickly they don't fact-check anything. And people assume that it's a bias. It's just the fact that they're not actually doing any investigation. They're just reporting the first thing they hear.
John, thanks for the call. John blaming the 24-hour news cycle for hurting reliability, I guess, and accuracy, it sounds like. First, what do you think of that, Mike?
Well, the 24-hour news cycle is probably not a net good for the ability of reporters to fact-check things and just for the ability for us as humans to take in information. So much is happening so fast, it's a real problem. But I think here's a situation where we're painting the news media with a very broad brush. For example, a story out today in the Washington Post reports that this guy James O'Keefe, who you might have heard of, is kind of an underground activist who tries to make liberals look bad in kind of undercover sting type operations. And apparently, it looks as though someone who might have worked for the organization that he runs, Project Veritas, contacted Washington Post reporters and then made up stories about Roy Moore, the guy running for Senate, the judge running for Senate in Alabama on the Republican side, who's been accused of being a sexual predator to underage girls. And lots of those stories have been verified by lots and lots of different sources. And O'Keefe, it appears, sent someone to try to get another story that's a false story that I don't want to repeat because I don't want to repeat a false story. And the reporters at the Post fact-checked it and never ran it because they couldn't demonstrate that it was true. And so I think there's more fact-checking going on than people think. But the 24-hour news cycle, your caller is still quite right that that's a problem. It affects how we take in information, and it affects how politicians try to get it out, and it affects the incentives the news media have to be new, now.
As we wrap up, I mean, if we're not trusting the news media, and the news media, let's talk mainstream media, however
sure.
We want to define that, they try to do their job to hold a politician accountable, and it's a politician we like, then our distrust, our walls go up. And I think this is true kind of across the spectrum, isn't it?
Human beings are very good at something psychologists call motivated reasoning. So if I learn something bad about the side that I like, I am motivated to find an argument that allows me to not trust that information. And it turns out that the educated are more guilty of this than anyone because they've been trained more at the art of making arguments and using evidence to support their point of view. And so it's a real problem when you hear something bad about your side. So liberals right now might have to think about Al Franken and John Conyers, two famous national politicians accused of behaving terribly to women. And so will they discount those stories? Are these times when liberals will say, I don't trust them? Or is it a time when liberals will say, gosh, I sure would rather be on the side of these people, but it seems like they've done something lousy and I think they should resign or take their lumps or something like that. And so it's a real problem. And there's not a simple fix to that human nature way of how we process negative information about our side.
We'll leave it there for now. Mike, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, associate professor at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about a UW survey of voters around the country looking into issues of trust in politicians and in the media.